the headlines, a video showing the fatal shooting of a young black man by a Michigan police officer leads to a public outcry in the U.S. Israeli forces killed two more Palestinians in a fresh raid into two West Bank villages amid growing public outrage across the occupied territories. Plus, Russia's top security official Dmitry Medvedev warns that Moscow will take measures in the Baltic if Sweden and Finland join NATO. Hello and welcome, everybody. 10 days ago, a white U.S. police officer fatally shot a black man, Patrick Leoya, in the state of Michigan. Now police have released footage of the moment of his death. Authorities say Patrick Leoya was killed after the officer's gun discharged during a lengthy struggle, but his family argue that he was shot execution style. According to several other released footage, initially the police stopped Leoya, claiming he was driving a car with a mismatched plate. Leoya started running and later got into a fight with the officer. Leoya tried to get hold of the officer's taser, after which the officer tackled him to the ground and shot him in the head a few seconds later. Michigan officials say an investigation is underway. The incident has triggered some protests and rallies in the U.S.
Justice for Patrick!
I said justice for Patrick!
Justice for Patrick!
You can't stop the revolution!
You can't stop!
The protesters called for justice for the 26-year-old Leoya and the black community. Leoya's attorney says the police shooting has been unnecessary and excessive. The officer who shot Leoya is currently under paid leave, but his police powers have been suspended. This is the latest example of U.S. police brutality against minorities in recent years. Israeli forces have conducted a fresh deadly raid into two Palestinian villages in the West Bank amid growing anti-regime anger. Across the occupied territory, soldiers killed two Palestinians and wounded several others during the operation that took place near the city of Jenin early this month. The crackdown triggered Palestinian protests. The Palestinian Health Ministry says the victims were hit with live ammunition. The latest fatalities bring to 10 the number of Palestinians killed at Israeli hands since the weekend. Resistance groups in the cities of Ramallah and Bethlehem have declared a general strike on Thursday. They're calling on the Palestinian public to intensify confrontations with Israel. The situation is highly volatile in the occupied territories. In recent weeks, there's been a flare-up in Palestinian retaliatory attacks, leaving over a dozen Israelis dead. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says the latest escalation in the occupied territories could turn into an uprising and a new intifada in Palestine.
Israeli forces again raided the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, this time at the town of Kfar Dan. Clashes erupted between Palestinians and Israeli forces there. At the end of the day, according to Palestinian paramedics, two Palestinians were shot dead by the Israeli forces. We have to mention that one of those Palestinians is the brother of Ayham Kamamji. Ayham Kamamji is a Palestinian prisoner who fled from the Israeli prison several months ago with five other prisoners. One of those Palestinians who was shot dead is the brother of Palestinian prisoner Ayham Kamamji. Clashes are still taking place in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Palestinian experts are warning that they could return back, let's say, to more clashes, more escalation. These killings by the Israeli forces and this escalation could any time turn into an uprising or an intifada. No one can tell, especially that the Israelis are saying they will not end their operation. It will continue until they could curb, let's say, according to them, terrorism. According to them, they could end the operations against the Israeli soldiers and the Israeli settlers.
As the conflict in Ukraine enters its 50th day, the war theater is shifting mainly to the east and south of the country. Here's the latest developments. Ukrainian forces claim they've damaged a Russian warship in the Black Sea with missile strikes. A Ukrainian official said a flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, carrying more than 500 crew members, has been targeted. Russia has confirmed that its missile cruise ship has been seriously damaged in a blast. Moscow says the ship's crew has been evacuated and the cause of the fire that caused the explosion is under investigation. The Russian Defense Ministry confirmed that its troops have now full control of the port in the besieged city of Mariupol. Moscow has also threatened to strike Ukraine's command centers in the capital, Kiev, if attacks on Russia continue. Moscow has accused Kiev's forces of attacking a territory in southern Russia. Commenting on the situation on the ground, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said a humanitarian ceasefire in Ukraine, quote, doesn't seem possible. Moscow issues fresh warnings to some Western states that might be mulling plans to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. The deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council says Moscow will take measures in the Baltic if Sweden and Finland join the Western military alliance. Dmitry Medvedev says if the two countries become part of NATO, a nuclear-free Baltic region will be off the table, adding that balance must be restored. According to Medvedev, even if Sweden and Finland join NATO, it won't make any big difference to Russia because that will only mean a few more opponents. Moscow is strongly opposed to NATO's eastward expansion and views it as a security threat. The conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine seems to be going beyond the military realm. Now independent media outlets say their dissenting voices are being silenced by the U.S. and its allies. In recent weeks, social media accounts of several news outlets have been blocked. An example would be the ASB News, whose editors say the suspension of their accounts has been a targeted takedown aimed at controlling the narrative on the war in Ukraine. They say that they're working to offer alternative information sources as opposed to the blatantly false information that the West provides about the conflict. We're now joined by independent geopolitical analyst Pepe Escobar, who's joining us from Bodrum. Mr. Escobar, welcome to the program. Before we go into the details about what's taking place on the ground, let's talk about the news item that we just read, that it seems that this conflict is taking shape in various different avenues as well. Independent media outlets are saying that their voices are being silenced. I've been told that your Twitter account has also been suspended. What can you tell us about that?
Well, they are absolutely desperate, no? Because they need to win the PR war for Western audiences. They already lost it inside Russia. The problem is what I call NATO stand, the specter of the whole NATO sphere. There's only one narrative that is allowed. It's the narrative that comes from the White House, the State Department, and the Pentagon. And all of us independents have been silenced little by little. And especially these past 2 weeks, the offensive is really, really hardcore. I had been warned already by connections in California that many of us were on their radars, because of course we are telling it like it is, what's really happening in especially Mariupol, in the cauldron in Donbass, the fact that Ukraine has absolutely no chance to win anything in this war. And of course, the only solution from the point of view of big tech is to cancel us. So it happened with Scott Ritter, two or three days before it happened with me. It happened with me yesterday. It happened with Russians with Attitude, an excellent Twitter account that migrated to Telegram as well. So the thing is, even if we are not on Twitter, which is a sort of modern-day agora of ancient Greece, where everybody drops in the central square and says something, it doesn't matter, because we are all migrating to Russian platforms and establishing ourselves in Russian platforms. And I hope we're going to have Indian platforms, Iranian platforms, Pakistani platforms, African platforms, Latin American platforms soon emerging all over. And that will be the end of big tech as controlling social networks, essentially.
Mr. Escobar, how is the West's arms supply for Ukraine affecting this conflict? In your opinion, is it prolonging the war? Is it helping boost Ukraine's defenses? What can you say?
Well, they think they can prolong the war sending old MiGs, you know, Kalashnikovs. Okay, and laws and javelins are not very effective. And laws, absolutely. The switchblade is a it could be a game changer. That's very complicated. But most of these weapons, they don't even arrive at their destination in different parts of in Kiev or in different parts of Ukraine, or they are immediately resold in the black market inside Ukraine. Ukraine nowadays is an enormous black hole, including many superimposed black markets as well. So this will never arrive, for instance, to from the point of view of Kiev, the people that really matter, which is the 80,000 to 100,000 troops, they are inside the different cauldrons in Donbas. And they have a choice sooner or later, rather sooner than later. Either they surrender or they're going to be totally exterminated. And that will be the end of the Ukrainian armed forces. But this this is also something that we simply cannot explain to Western social networks. It's on the ground. There's excellent Russian and a few foreign reporters on the ground documenting all that. But this is absolute. It's out of the question to be filtered inside for Western public opinion, especially American and Western European.
And what are your predictions for the battle that's looming for the Donbas region in the east?
Well, we cannot predict anything about. In fact, everything that so-called military analysts, Westerners, 99%, I would say, predicted went wrong. What we follow is movements on the ground and what we could define as the Russian high command strategic ambiguity, because they we can never tell what's going to be their next major move, apart, of course, from how they're going to eliminate the different cauldrons inside the big cauldron in Donbas. This is something that, from the point of view of the Russians, it should be accomplished throughout this month, until the end of April, mostly, because then that will free the bulk of the Russian forces and some extra forces that they will bring from Russia, probably by the end of the month, to go to other areas and secure other areas, which we still don't know, because this is a Russian military secret. Nobody can say that they know what the Russian military are going to do next. So what we can follow is movements on the ground, like Mariupol, for instance. It has been a horrendous battle, because everybody knew that different sectors of Azov and Aidar neo-Nazi battalions were entrenched in different parts of Mariupol. So we took more than a month to liberate Mariupol, and now the last stretch is in the Azovstal steelworks, which is going to happen anyway eventually. They are discussing how they're going to do it, with flamethrowers, by flooding the underground, bunker buster bombs, you name it. And all of us and all of those armchair specialists in the West, they cannot tell, because it's the Russian high command which is going to take the last decisions, and we never know what they're going to do next.
And one last question for you, Mr. Escobar. When we look at, as you mentioned earlier, the mainstream and Western media's coverage to this war, and all the international response to the conflict in Ukraine, one notion comes to mind, and that's hypocrisy and double standards. I'd like you to further elaborate on that notion for us. The war in Ukraine, it's seen a different international response than the war on Yemen, the war in Syria, the occupation in Palestine. What can you tell us about trying to draw comparisons between all of these different wars?
You're absolutely correct, because all the wars of conquest, rape, pillage, and plunder by the empire for the past over the past 50 years, in fact, they simply disappeared. It's like the only war that exists is the war unleashed by the evil new Hitler, Vladimir Putin. This is beyond any rationalization of hypocrisy, in fact. Of course, the genocide in Yemen, which is a real genocide, had already disappeared from the Western narrative for the past few years, in fact. And now it's completely obliterated. Same with Palestine. Everything that happened in Syria when the Americans were using a proxy war to destroy the Syrian nation also disappeared completely. And obviously, it's impossible for, I would say, especially the Americans, and of course the European poodles that follow them, to understand and to put in context and in perspective how imperialism survives or has been survived for the past few decades based on these wars of choice, essentially, absolutely illegal. They destroy whole nations in the global south. And what basically led to the Russian response to the situation in Ukraine was many different factors. The fact that the Russians knew that there were biolabs in Ukraine, and this was confirmed. The Russians knew that Ukraine was making some moves to restart a nuclear program. This was also confirmed. The fact that they were NATO essentially was organizing a huge blitzkrieg. There would be a blitzkrieg cum genocide in Donbass was also, everything was confirmed. So they had to act now as a sort of preemptive attack against NATO essentially. And this war is not Kiev against Moscow. This war is NATO against Moscow. And this is also another information that simply cannot be analyzed in Western social networks.
Thanks a lot, sir. Pepe Escobar, independent geopolitical analyst, joining us from Bodrum. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Tehran, irrespective of whoever the Pakistani people elect to power, will always stand beside Islamabad in the interest of regional peace and stability, and of course, against American hegemony. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading Iran fully supports Pakistan's independence and sovereignty. Stay tuned for more. News from neighboring Pakistan say thousands of people are out on the streets protesting the unceremonious exit of Prime Minister Imran Khan by his opponents in the parliament, who analysts in Islamabad, Lahore and Karachi say seem to be more concerned about good relations with the US instead of national sovereignty. This became clear recently when the Prime Minister-elect made the fears of the Pakistani people that the country has become a client state of the US come true, by saying he will work for better relations with the US without setting any conditions for Washington for reciprocal respect. We in Iran wish all the best for the fraternal and friendly nation of Pakistan, both people and the politicians. But one thing that baffles us is what Islamabad has gained from its one-sided friendly relations with Washington. Other than exploitation of the Pakistani elite's blind love for the make-believe glamour and dazzle of the American way of life, that in return brings in a few modern aircraft and military hardware which lack teeth, no administration in the so-called White House, whether Democrat or Republican, has ever shown any respect for the country, always calling it failed state. Pakistan was viewed as nothing more than a base by the American military for sabotage operations in Afghanistan and the 20-year occupation of that landlocked country that followed. The U.S. hates to see the 220 million-strong nuclear-armed Muslim country use its potential to overcome its economic and other problems for the simple reason that, like the Islamic Republic of Iran, a powerful and independent Pakistan would inspire other Muslim states of the region to coordinate efforts for Islamic unity and creation of a powerful regional bloc. This is clear by constant U.S. pressures on the various governments in Islamabad against having full-fledged cooperation with the Islamic Republic of Iran in the fields of economy, industry, culture, commerce, etc., despite the fact that the two Muslim neighbors share many historical commonalities and in spite of membership in the 10-nation Economic Cooperation Organization, ECO. The most glaring example in this regard is the reluctance of the successive administration in Islamabad to carry out an activated section of the natural gas pipeline, which Iran has completed right till the borders of Pakistan. It is still not too late for the politicians of Pakistan to take stock of the one-sided relations with the U.S., the arch enemy of Islam and Muslims, to charter an independent course on the basis of God's commandments in the Noble Quran and the practical precedents set by Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny regarding statecraft. As said earlier, Tehran, irrespective of whoever the Pakistani people elect to power, will always stand beside Islamabad in the interest of regional peace and stability and, of course, against American hegemony.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Systemic racism holding back black Americans. That is the assessment of a U.S. civil rights group, the National Urban League, who has said that the median household income for black people in the U.S. is 37% lower than that of white people. Why does racism in all of its forms, like in this case income, still persist in the U.S. to the extent that it does? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why it is difficult for people of color to overcome systemic racism in the U.S. in all of its forms.
An annual report by a New York-based civil rights organization has once again turned the spotlight on systemic racism and bias in the United States. The National Urban League's report showed that African Americans, despite making economic and health gains, still get just about 74% of what white people enjoy in the country. The organization demonstrates how difficult it is for people of color to overcome systemic racism.
These numbers change so little and so slowly. What it tells me is that this institutional disparity based on race seems to be built into American society.
The findings show the median household income for black people is 37% less than that of white people and are less likely to benefit from home ownership. The report also touches upon educational gaps.
Black and white preschoolers are roughly equally prepared, but the classrooms they enter are starkly different. Schools with more minority students are more likely to have inexperienced, less trained, and even uncertified teachers. Fewer of these students are enrolled in the STEM classes that can lead to higher-paying jobs. Black students are less likely to graduate from college.
On voting rights, the report says state legislatures have been restricting voting access in districts with large populations of black Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans. The report also points to U.S. Justice Department statistics saying black people have been more than twice as likely as their white counterparts to experience threats or uses of force during police encounters and three times more likely to be jailed if arrested. The grim findings come nearly 2 years after the U.S. underwent a major reckoning on racism following the brutal killing of African-American George Floyd by a white police officer. His death ignited nationwide protests and demands for equality and end to police brutality against people of color. Nonetheless, the National Urban League's report has highlighted the fact that racial inequality in the U.S. is deep-rooted. It stems from years of injustice and institutionalized racism against African Americans and other minority groups, which worsened during Donald Trump's presidency. Anti-racism demonstrations have also failed to bring about any tangible change in previous years.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, who joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us, Joseph Richardson, professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at the University of Maryland from Laurel, Maryland.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Gerald Horn, let me first start with you. And I have to say, if you did not catch on, that this was a report by the civil rights group National Urban League. So obviously your opinion of that organization is very important. But basically, one of the conclusions it has reached is that systemic racism is holding back black Americans. And it says black people in the U.S. are trailing white people in critical areas. That includes wealth, education, social justice, health, and civic engagement. Are you surprised at that, first of all?
No, I'm not surprised. And those who are surprised have not been paying attention to U.S. history. That is to say, when the European settlers and colonists began invading in North America in the 1500s and 1600s, they set up a society that was exclusive. It was only tended to benefit those who were like themselves. They liquidated the indigenous population for the most part, and then handcuffed Africans and dragged them across the Atlantic to be slaves. And we have not been able to transcend that original sin to the point where, as your reporter suggested, the prisons are overflowing with Black Americans. Black Americans are more likely to be subjected to the death penalty, that is to say, executed by the arm of the state. Black people are more likely to be shot down in the streets by the police forces. And with regard to housing discrimination, the latest revelation is that if a Black person is trying to sell their home, they find they can get more for their home if they take down the pictures on the walls of their Black relatives and leave the walls bare, or put up pictures of those who are defined as white. I can think of no worse example of the kind of white supremacy that obtains in the United States of America.
Joseph Richardson, this National Urban League actually produced the first state of Black America in its report that, based on what it said, it captured the plight of the people who had been victims of systemic racism since arriving, as it said, in the shores of the U.S. And when you take a look at the year that report was published, it was back in 1976. Of course, Gerald Horn there goes back even further. When you have organizations like this and similar to this issuing out alarm bells and describing how this systemic racism is going on and is still, based on its most recent report, is even in some sense gotten worse, then why aren't there any action plans set forward? Or have they, and it's just not working?
I believe that there have been action plans that have been set forward, and there are many scholars who have addressed the wealth gap in this country. We only need to look at the work of economist Sandy Darity at Duke University, who has been making the argument for reparations, and we've heard discussions and policies recommending and advocating for reparations across this nation. But if to hark back onto the work of Dr. Darity, found just in terms of the wealth gap in America, and it's quite interesting that we often emphasize the educational gaps, but what Dr. Darity found in terms of the differences in wealth is that white Americans, even those who have not graduated from high school and dropped out of high school, have greater wealth than Black Americans who have a college degree. And so his argument is that there really isn't a way to educate ourselves out of the great wealth gap and disparities that we have between Blacks and whites without having another form of remediation, and that would be in the form of reparations. Because as you mentioned, that report was made in 1976, and not much has changed in terms of Black wealth over the past 50 years. And in fact, we know that during the Obama administration, Black Americans actually lost more wealth because much of our wealth has been tied to home ownership. And so that intergenerational transference of wealth hasn't happened in the same way for Black Americans as it has traditionally benefited white Americans in this country.
One of the most alarming, at least in terms of what I saw, Gerald Horn, of this report is how it talked about voting rights. And taking a look at the statement that it made there, it was very interesting in the way that it described it. And it said that it was actually an anti-democratic move that began after the 2008 election, when Black voting rates actually matched white voting rates for the first time, which catapulted Barack Obama into office. This sounds an awful lot like a UN report that recently came out talking about voting rights of minorities denied in parts of the U.S., mentioning Texas as one of those states. That sounds like Black voting is being, or Black votes are being suppressed. Is that what this is about, which is resulting in gerrymandering? And perhaps you can describe that for us.
Well, gerrymandering is the process whereby congressional districts or state legislative districts are drawn in such a way as to oftentimes dilute the effectiveness of the black vote. That is normative, particularly in a state like Texas. You also need to realize that one of the reasons that this takes place is that the black voter tends to vote against conservatives, vote against the Republicans, vote against the right wing at a higher rate than any other demographic category, oftentimes reaching 9-1. And so it is in the material interest of the conservatives, of the Republicans, to try to dilute, if not obliterate, black voting power. If that were the only problem that we faced, of course, that would be formidable. But to return to the economic question, there is the question of employment discrimination. You've had recently attempts to pass laws, for example, to prevent employers from discriminating against people who have hair like mine. That is to say, it's quite usual, quite typical for black women to face discrimination because of having hair like this, a category that they have nothing to do with. That is the essence, obviously, of blatant discrimination. And the fact that you have to pass a law to address that says more than I could ever articulate.
Well, if you want to talk about the economy, this is definitely an eye-opener. And it's not new news. Joseph Richardson, I don't know if you're even aware of it. Hopefully you are, and perhaps you can spread the word. But there was one report that came out in 2020 by a major U.S. Banking group, Citigroup, that said the U.S. economy has lost $16 trillion because of discrimination. Now this, again, it came out in 2020. There was another report that came out that was cited by the San Francisco Federal Reserve President Mary Daly that said that the racial and ethnic inequities have cost the U.S. economy some $51 trillion. Now I do have to say this is not just lost revenue from blacks, but also people of color. But still, it's a really large figure. You would think the U.S. government would address this, and I think at some point Joe Biden did address that in his presidential campaign, that he is aware of this.
Well, while President Biden may be aware of it, again, it takes the political will of our policymakers in order to implement and execute policies that will actually effectively address these issues. And so, again, I think what you're saying is has an historical context to it. The work of Lisa Cook, an economist at Michigan State, does some really rigorous scholarship in terms of black patents and the number of patents that have been stolen from black scientists and inventors, and what that has cost the U.S. economy, I think contributes in many respects to the number that you just noted. But we also have to think in terms of and the number of people that are not leaving, that are unable to get a college education, who can create and contribute to the economy by being scientists and incubators of innovation, and how that has impacted black Americans as well, in addition to preventing us from entering into small businesses, by preventing us from getting loans. And we recently saw in Wells Fargo, just in terms of black wealth again, that far more black applicants were denied recently from getting home loans and particularly refinancing loans than white applicants. And so all of this in combination, whether it's the lack of our being able to build our human capital, which ultimately may tie into our social and financial capital, plays an instrumental role in accumulating our wealth. And so the statistics that you just noted, I don't find them surprising at all, understanding and knowing the context of the way structural racism has played out in terms of even the scientists and innovation in terms of patents among black people in this country.
Sure. And of course, Gerald Horn, I do have to say that this is not something that the U.S. is just the U.S. experiencing, but also a phenomenon around the world. When this report was described, Gerald Horn, it said, in different, mind you, websites, it said that the report came nearly 2 years after the U.S. experienced what it called a major reckoning on racism in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd. Now, we know that this type of racism has existed before. Do you agree, or why do you think the reason is that the report or the description of the report is stated as such, that it comes after what it calls a major reckoning after the death of George Floyd or the killing of George Floyd?
Well, I would say that it was a reckoning. I'm not so sure it was a major reckoning, because if it was a major reckoning, we would not be discussing the dismal report that's now on our agenda. For those who may not recall, in May 2020, the black man known as George Floyd was executed on tape by police officers in the state of Minnesota. That led to mass protests across the country and indeed in many parts of the world. That is the so-called major reckoning that took place. But it takes more, I'm afraid to say, than a spate of demonstrations to erode the encrusted bigotry that has accumulated over the decades and over the centuries in the United States of America. And in fact, I dare say that given the fact that inflation is now racking the U.S. economy, and indeed the economies of a goodly number of advanced capitalist countries, you can expect these kinds of dismal reports to be issued regularly. Because when there are economic downturns, oftentimes the rate and regularity of racism accelerates. And I'm afraid to say that that's maybe on the agenda as we speak.
Well, it's very alarming, I would think, Joseph Richardson, when you take a look at what the report has said regarding representation in Congress. And it said people of color made up 90% of the population growth in North Carolina, 95% of the population growth in Texas. Yet the communities of color in those states have seen decreased representation in Congress. Now, if I'm in the White House and I'm reading this, I should be alarmed, because what if this were to spread to more states? Because as this report indicated, for example, you have a major increase in the number of populations that are the spending that occurs from consumers. And at the same time, you have, for example, incomes that are 37% less than that of white people, as is said, for black people. My question being, there needs to be an equality of some sorts to be applied here, whether it's a representation in Congress, income, and what have you. Do you see any major movements to that effect?
No, but I would say that we have not had the same level of representation in Congress that was reflective of the black population since Reconstruction. We had far more senators and congressmen that were of African-American descent in Congress during Reconstruction than we've had since then. So, I mean, there's a historical context to this, which isn't just playing out recently. I mean, we're talking about well over 100 years. So, and just in terms of, again, we need to think about in terms of who we are voting for. How are we casting our vote? Dr. Horn mentioned that we typically vote against conservatives, but we also have to revisit, just in terms of our own economic health and survival, what has the Democratic Party done to deliver our vote? And we have several scholars that have made the argument that maybe African Americans should form more of a voting bloc than to just freely give their vote over to the Democratic Party, because it hasn't resulted in any kind of economic advancement for Black Americans, whether in terms of economically or even in terms of our civil rights agenda. And so, again, I think we need to retrench and think more critically about what has the Democratic Party done for Black Americans in terms of advancing our economics, advancing the health of our communities, our life expectancy, and the educational systems, as well as the criminal justice system, which we haven't seen many gains for African Americans, regardless of what party we choose to elect and place into office. And so maybe it is time for us to think about how we can leverage our vote in terms of leveraging our vote with who needs our vote the most in terms of what we will get out of it, and in terms of placing it specific candidates in office and not thinking specifically along party lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gerald Horn, what do you think about that? At this point, do you see the Democratic Party failing in delivering on its promises, especially when it comes to either people of color or African-Americans or blacks? Or do you see that the Democratic Party is not doing that, and therefore there needs to be another kind of representation for, and I'm going to put people of color as a whole, and then blacks or African-Americans specifically?
Well, I would like to add another factor, which is that if you look historically, the crucial and critical factor that helps to propel black people in particular forward has been the global context. It's no accident that U.S. apartheid, legalized discrimination and racism, began to retreat 70-odd years ago when the United States is under international pressure as African and Caribbean nations are coming to independence and the socialist camp is bidding for influence amongst those nations. The U.S. decides that the better part of wisdom is to try to execute an agonizing retreat away from the more egregious and horrible aspects of Jim Crow. I agree that left to its own devices, the road ahead for black people will be quite rocky. But that's where our international allies, particularly our allies and friends in Iran, can intervene, because just as our friends in Iran are under pressure from Washington and from the right wing and from those who rule the United States, black people are under pressure from the right wing as well. So I would urge our friends overseas, not least in Iran, to speak out on our behalf, because that would be in your interest and that would be in our interest.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. We appreciate that. Gerald Horn, Professor of History and African American Studies from the University of Houston. Thank you so much. Joseph Richardson, thank you. Professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at the University of Maryland. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tafway and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
voices back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen, the loyal audience of IRB English Radio, welcome to another episode of Back to Reality. In the realm of truth, we have two very dear guests. Now I want them to introduce themselves to you. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK, and I'm studying in the holy city of Qom. Alhamdulillah.
Such a pleasure to be with you. So you're studying religion?
Yeah, I'm studying in the Hawza.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm Sadiqa from the UK as well. And I'm studying in Qom as well, in the Sisters Hawza. And my field of study is Fiqh and Usul. One more term left.
Oh,
and,
very great. So just for those audience and listeners who do not know what is Fiqh and Usul, can you please tell us a little bit about your area of study?
So
what do you do?
Fiqh and Usul is basically the principles of jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at every marja taqlid has a book of laws. How do they derive those laws?
And now we go to another word, marja taqlid.
Marja taqlid. Every Shia would choose
a scholar to follow
in their daily ahkam rules, in the daily rules, such as with different parts of ahkam, so religious rulings. I also study how they're derived.
Mm-hmm.
You have different subjects within fiqh and usul, within the principles of jurisprudence. And we look at the different principles, how those principles are derived, how the laws are derived, the hadith and the Quran related to those laws, which basically comes down to the nitty-gritty of your ahkam.
So plenty much of delicate things to study.
There's a lot of attention to detail, yes.
Yes, exactly, details. So wish you best of luck.
Thank you.
I hope you do well in that major. Now, let's go to the heart of our discussion for today's Back to Reality. Here's the thing. 5 minutes after we're being born, everything has been given to us. We have no choice over where we live, where we have been born, our nationality, our parents, many things, right?
Yes, definitely.
But how does it feel?
Well, it's a necessity.
It's weird.
It's not, because we live in a world where if you don't have a nationality, the nationality of a person also comes down to the fact that those laws of the country now apply to that person, even if they're 1 minute old.
Mm-hmm.
Every person has rights, and those rights have to be abided by.
It seems like you were satisfied where you have been born, in what family you have been born.
No, because we are born, but we are the ones who have to carve out our future as well. Just being born in a specific place does not hurt a person, rather.
As but they can grow up, change many things in their future.
Our futures, yes, they can change, but everything is not, it's not all of our lives are predetermined.
Mm-hmm.
We have free will of how we go ahead. So yes, I might have been born in a specific family, but how I move ahead is down to me. It's not down
to
my family.
That is the part which is related to free will. Brother Muzaffar.
I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. 5 minutes after I was born, I don't remember a thing. So I wouldn't
you
be able to.
You don't remember, but now we can know.
I wouldn't be able to elaborate on how I felt at those labels being slapped onto me and being given my name and everything.
Perhaps 15 years later, you understood what you have been through.
Yeah. I'm still thinking about it, though. Yeah.
Yes.
There are things.
Many people, you know, they're not satisfied with the place they've been born, the setting, you know. Everything has been set for us. We come into it and we can change maybe some specific things.
It goes back to, I think it was Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam or Imam Ridha alayhi salam. But he was asked at a very young age, he must have been like 10 years old, maybe younger.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked by the Taghut of the time, how much free will do we have and how much, you know, predestination is involved in our life? And he said, stand on one leg. And he stood on one leg. And then he said, now raise the other leg as well. And he said, I can't. He said, it's like this.
Wasn't that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam?
I remember it being Imam Musa al-Kadhim. Let's just say
so,
the Imam
yes.
alayhi salam. And so, yeah, it's almost 50-50. you could argue that. That mm-hmm. there is an element that is tying you down to earth. You can't avoid that. You are going to be given your name at birth. You're going to be given, which of course you can change later on, by the way, in life, right?
Yes, but you have to grow very old.
How you
to
look, your genetics. All of these things are going to be, even your personality, by the way.
Yes, they people, say that they come through genes.
Right, genes and a number of other factors. Mm-hmm. And I know that some people are interested in zodiac and things like this. But at the end of the day, personality itself, which is something that people would not like to hear.
But also that is affected by the place you have been born in.
Your personality? No,
yes,
I mean
the
innate, the fitra. The fitra mm-hmm. of that personality, right? So that is not going to change.
Explain the word fitra for us.
Right. So the fitra is, let's translate it as the divine innate nature of a human being. Okay.
Shall we call it the unconscious?
No, I wouldn't. Everybody has a subconscious, right?
Yes.
The subconscious mind is just like this bank where you can, it's just a store place where mm-hmm. you keep all sorts of thoughts and images everything goes into it. It's like a big storeroom. But
so, you
definitely.
Know, in psychology, we had something that was called collective unconscious. Mm-hmm. And every time I read things about that, I remembered the word fitra.
Alhamdulillah.
You know, because that is very close to it. You know, they say all the human beings have got a history that is buried back in their brain.
Yeah.
We all are the same in that point.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
The discussion of what the fitra is a lengthy discussion in of itself.
Exactly.
We have a verse of the Quran about it.
We don't want to go away from what we're talking about.
Yeah, coming back to the idea that, look, there are certain things that you don't have control over.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is not that you want to control those. The idea is that you become, first of all, satisfied. You understand the decree of Allah is such that, yes, I was born into certain circumstances with a certain background, into a certain family, into a certain climate and culture. Now, what am I going to do with it?
So that is that count.
That's what really counts,
yes.
Right? That's what really matters, what you do with what you were born mm-hmm. with.
Yes. So now, sister, we have been born into a setting that has been predetermined for us. Now, what can I do to change the rest? You know, I have been surrounded by an environment, by people that have been predetermined for me. Now I want to change it. I'm talking about free will. I mean, because many people might say, these are all, you know, the naturalistic people usually called it, the thing that is going to determine our future is the environment that we are living in, which is the nature that we're living in, and then the genes, the biology that I have been born with. Now, if we want to describe on free will, what will we say? If we consider that the place that I've been born has been decided for me, people around me have been decided for me, how shall I call myself a person with free will?
First, the family we are born with, mm-hmm. yes, it's been determined for us. But not those around us. We have the choice of who we choose as friends.
Mm-hmm.
We have the choice of who we associate ourselves with. These are not determined for us. These are free will. This is how I choose to go ahead in life.
Mm-hmm.
If I choose a friend who's into drugs and alcohol, that's my fault.
But don't you think that also is related to the family I was born in?
No, again, it comes down to free will. A lot of the times we have the option of choosing what to do. It may be we may make a mistake in what we choose, but that does not mean that we don't have free will. It's just mm-hmm. a mistake that I made the wrong choice. Family, yes, sometimes. But again, with family as well, today we live in a very vast world where